If I say thesaurus, you probably think Roget. If I say encyclopedia, you may say Britannica. And if I say anatomy, well, I'm guessing you're thinking Gray. Gray's Anatomy was first published in 1858, the original title, Anatomy Descriptive and Surgical, and it's been continuously revised and reprinted since 1858. There's also, of course, the medical drama on TV named after it. And actually, the making of the book was also something of a medical drama. Hello, I'm Amanda Smith, and this is The Body Sphere. So who is this Gray? He was Henry Gray in mid-19th century London, an up-and-coming young anatomist, surgeon and fellow of the Royal Society. He was well-connected, well-off and on the fast track to success. The anatomy book was probably his idea, even though there were a number of others around at the time. So what was new or different about Gray's Anatomy that meant it immediately became the definitive text? Ruth Richardson is the author of The Making of Mr. Gray's Anatomy.
Well, Gray didn't write much that was original in the text in Gray's Anatomy, but what he did do was he was a good anatomist and he took information from lots of different sources and made it into a sort of definitive description for the time, written from his experience as an anatomist plus all the anatomy books he'd been using to teach from. And actually he was accused of plagiarism, but anyway, we should come to that later. But what's special about the book, actually, is the illustrations.
So who did the illustrations, do you know? Not Henry Gray, but another Henry, Henry Van Dyke Carter. The two met at St George's Hospital in London. Gray was lecturing in anatomy, Carter was a demonstrator. Both were in their 20s, but Carter was doing it the hard way to become a doctor and surgeon. He was provincial, deeply religious, but nonconformist, and socially inferior to Gray.
A very interesting man who's really got lost, and I partly wrote the book to put him back on the world map, you know. Carter was quite an introvert, but quite ambitious. He knew he was very intelligent, and he knew he had potential, but he thought one should succeed in the world by one's own merits, which is a very nonconformist way of behaving and very honourable. Gray had no qualms about pulling strings at all. And also Gray, apart from his own social climbing, he also had a predatory interest in Carter's work.
As in he was using him?
Yes. He used him as an illustrator for various things that he wrote and published, prize-winning things and publications, without giving Carter any credit, without putting his name on the images. And so people cited Gray's work as though the images were his, and actually they weren't his. He paid for them, but he didn't do them. And that made for difficulty at the outset of the Gray's Anatomy project.
Nevertheless, Carter did agree. Now, the title page of the first edition makes it clear that this anatomy book was created through dissections, performed jointly by Gray and Carter. And this really reminds you that the illustrations are of real people. But by what process were Gray and Carter getting bodies for dissection?
They came out of the hospital mortuary or out of a workhouse where they died. A really nasty Act of Parliament was passed in Britain in 1832, which put an end to body snatching.
It succeeded.
Yes, but it did so by, instead of giving hanged murderers, there weren't enough hanged murderers, you see, and that was why people went out to rob from graves. Instead of giving hanged murderers, they gave the poor. So if you died in a workhouse or a hospital and you didn't have enough money for your own funeral, you could be taken for anatomy. And that created such an upset in the culture, it gave tremendous fear of hospitals and workhouses. And I mean, it worked to stop body snatching because the corpse supply was free of charge, so it undercut the market. Very interestingly, there had been a free market, and body snatching was the result of that. It was a very nasty culture that they were intervening in, but they didn't make it any better by just giving the poor.
So the illustrations for Gray's Anatomy come from these people who come from the workhouses,
yes,
and or the hospitals.
Yes, and they're all nameless. We don't know who they all were. No names.
It's a dark and somewhat shady thing, all that. But Carter's illustrations represent the bodies with a certain degree of respect, I think.
They do, absolutely they do. And that's partly why I think Gray's anatomy had such an appeal. What he does, because of his religious background, he sees the human body as the image of God. And if you think the human body is the image of God, then you're not going to treat it badly in illustrations. You're going to treat it with dignity. And so he looks at these people who are the poorest of the poor as though he's mapping the human body as an image of God. If you look at the faces and the postures of the bodies in that first edition, you'll see that they've got a dignity to them which is quite unlike illustrations in contemporary anatomy books.
Well, that was 150 odd years ago, but what's the appeal of Gray's anatomy in more recent times? Let's go to hospital.
I'm Professor Bill Johnson. I'm the Program Director of Surgery, Anaesthesia, Perioperative Medicine and Ambulatory Care at Alfred Health, and I'm a surgeon.
And that's the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne, and that's a fantastically long title, Bill.
It's a very long title.
So did you use Gray's anatomy when you were a medical student?
Yes, I did. I mean, in those days, anatomy, of course, formed a very large part of our preclinical work. Almost a whole of the second year was devoted to anatomy, and Gray's anatomy itself was a fantastic reference book.
Did you see it matter-of-factly, you know, in a practical sense, or did you see, was there any beauty in the illustrations, for example, for you?
Well, I think the descriptions of the anatomy in Gray's were very old-world sort of type of descriptions, so it was almost like reading the classics. And the actual anatomical diagrams were not as modern as the new textbooks, but again, they had this sort of classical sort of nature about them, which was really quite beautiful. And in fact, it was a most enjoyable book to read because it had little anecdotes as well as you went along. And it was, if you read it from cover to cover, it would be something which would be fairly tiresome. But choosing areas that you wanted to look at specifically, it provided a great degree of detail and interest.
Does it still appeal to modern students? Do modern medical students use it?
Well, on my way here, Amanda, I went home to pick it up so I could bring it in to show you, but my son, who's planning to practice to study anatomy, he has actually confiscated it while he's away on his country rotation. So it's still used as a reference book, and I must say I was giving a talk on head and neck anatomy and I stole some of the diagrams from Gray's anatomy to use it. I mean, Gray's anatomy has got got great clinical diagrams in there which are absolutely irreplaceable, really. So they've always got a relevance for all medical students, all people who are studying anatomy, and I guess these days, disappointingly, not all medical students study anatomy in great detail. I was brought up on believing that anatomy was one of the bases of the study of medicine, and I still believe that.
Why has it become less important in training?
Well, I think that there are so many other things to be squeezed into a curriculum that people realise that if you're not going to go into surgery, you probably don't need to know anything more than that's the arm and that's the leg.
Yeah, so as a surgeon these days, do you really need to memorise absolutely every nook and cranny of the human body?
Well, I guess one would argue about that, but I mean, if you're interested in something, you should know every nook and cranny in the body. So I guess as a surgeon, I think that it's an interest that you have, and I guess really you go into as many nook and crannies as you can, but I must say that I couldn't recite all the nook and crannies from Gray's Anatomy, I can promise you that.
So what had anatomical illustrations been like before Gray's, and what was the context that produced Gray's Anatomy? Richard Barnett is a medical historian, a fellow at the Wellcome Trust in the UK, and the author of The Sick Rose, Disease and the Art of Medical Illustration. He says that the period between the French Revolution and the First World War, so essentially the 19th century, was a golden age in medical image making.
Firstly, there's a great revolution in ideas about the body. This is what historians like me refer to as Paris medicine sometimes. It's a shift away from older classical Greek and Roman ideas that disease is fundamentally a matter of balance and imbalance within the body, and towards what we'd recognise as a more modern and scientific view of disease as some kind of physical material process going on within the body. So at the most basic level, there's a change in how doctors are thinking about the human body and how it goes wrong. But what's going on at the same time, of course, in Europe and the US, is the Industrial Revolution and everything we associate with that. So there are new techniques of mass printing, new techniques for producing detailed illustrations.
Well, by way of getting to your period, can we go back earlier to the most famous Renaissance book of medical illustrations by Vesalius.
Of course.
What do those illustrations look like? What distinguishes them?
If you open a book of Vesalius, I think the first thing that will strike you is the remarkable detail. The images themselves are woodcuts, so they have a very distinctively, I suppose you'd say, sort of late medieval Renaissance kind of look to them. But perhaps the most important thing about these images is the context in which they're produced. Vesalius is writing in a time when ideas about the body are very largely determined by religion, especially by Christianity. And he's also very self-consciously setting himself in the tradition of Renaissance art. So if you look at Vesalius's dissections, they're very often positioned in a classical landscape, and the figures, many of which have been dissected in quite radical ways, are often positioned contemplating a skull or in prayer, something like that. So they're speaking to a much more self-consciously artistic tradition.
Then by the 18th century, you get very grand, full-colour anatomical atlases, don't you? And then into the 19th century, they become much less lavish again. Why is this? What's the difference? What's going on?
It seems to me that in the 18th century, you have some very beautiful anatomical works being produced, especially by John and William Hunter in London. But these are being produced in comparatively small numbers by anatomists working for a small group of subscribers. So these aren't really mass circulation books. They're very, very finely engraved. They were often produced through copperplate engraving, and you can get some very, very fine results from that. But in the 19th century, you get new techniques like lithography and so on that allow thousands and thousands of copies of reproduced images to be made. So I think it's really this technological revolution and the fact that medicine itself is changing in this period. Through the 18th century into the 19th century, you get an explosion in medical schools, anatomy schools throughout Europe and the US. There are many more medical students wanting to learn this stuff, and frankly, they don't have the money to buy a very lavishly Morocco-bound edition of Hunter's works. So these new 19th century mass-produced textbooks are responding to this new demand from a very large number of medical students and people wanting to study anatomy.
What interests me is the persistence of illustration in medicine well after the invention of photography. To what extent was photography also used for anatomy, for anatomical representation in the 19th century?
It certainly starts to be used. Photography really comes into medicine through the 1840s and 1850s, and one of the first places it's used is in psychiatry, to record the appearance and the behaviour of people suffering from various kinds of mental illness, as we now call it.
This is through their facial expressions.
Facial expressions, bodily positions, all that sort of thing. But there's actually a big problem with photography for anatomy. If you take a photograph, especially if you take a photograph using one of these early cameras, the photograph gives equal emphasis to pretty much everything within the field of view. Now, the point of an anatomical illustration is to teach, is to pass on knowledge. And for that reason, anatomical images are often, especially as we get towards the late 19th century, they're often being simplified. If you look at the most famous 19th century anatomical work, Gray's Anatomy, the drawings in there are quite simple. They're very plain line drawings. And the use of a technique like that allows you to draw out and give emphasis to exactly what you want the reader to take from that image. The problem with a photograph is that actually it's got too much information. There's too much going on.
And so in the age of photography, the most famous book of anatomy to emerge, as you say, is Gray's Anatomy. It has illustrations that are simple black and white woodcuts. Now, it's first published in 1858. Why do you think it's such a classic?
Well, firstly, and let's not forget this. Gray's Anatomy is cheap, and it's a very good textbook. As I say, there's a new mass market for this kind of book in the 19th century, and in some ways, the success of Gray simply reflects the fact that it's responding to that. It fits the bill very, very nicely. But you're right; it's fascinating if you look at the images that, in some ways, they look back to Vesalius. They're using a technique that really hasn't been used in anatomical publishing for a couple of hundred years. And as I say, this is partly to do with the idea of simplicity. If you look at the drawings in Gray's, they look like engineering blueprints. They look very 19th century in that sort of way. So it's fascinating that just as photography is coming in as a technique, older traditions of anatomical image making are becoming simpler. they're not becoming more complex like photographs. They're actually becoming simpler like the illustrations in Grays. So I think that the great success of Grays is partly due to the fact that, on the one hand, it looks backwards towards the tradition of Vesalius, but on the other hand, it looks forward to the 20th century. It looks forward to engineering blueprints and schematic diagrams of circuitry and so on, the ways that we've come to accept knowledge being represented.
And Richard Barnett is the author of The Sick Rose, taking its title from the William Blake poem, a book of medical illustrations dating from the 1790s to the 1910s. Amanda Smith with you, on air and online, and this is The Body Sphere. Dr. Karen Hitchcock is a physician. She also writes the medical column for the monthly magazine. And Karen's favourite anatomy book, when she was at medical school, wasn't Grey's Anatomy. It was a photographic book.
I think my favourite one was probably not the one that was most useful. My favourite one was a book by Rowan and Yokochi, and it's a photographic atlas of anatomy. It's a very large, very heavy book, and it is entirely made up of photographs of bodies that have been dissected by masters in dissection, and the photos are exquisite.
And what do photographs do for you that diagrams don't do?
In terms of me having to learn the structures of the body, the photographs weren't actually useful. The diagrams, in that they were schematic and idealised and simplified, were much more useful for that. So it wasn't so much that that photographic atlas helped me memorise the anatomy of the human body, but it just somehow made me realise what a dead person looks like and what's underneath our skin in a more philosophical way.
So what a dead person looks like dissected.
Yes, exactly. Because the specimens that were used in the anatomy lab at my medical school were quite old and had been preserved for a very long time, and they were in parts because we didn't dissect ourselves, which is pretty common now in medical schools that students don't dissect cadavers. We have already resected specimens, and they were stored in these big plastic vats with signs on them like arms, legs and neck with head, and you'd have to put on gloves that came up to your armpit nearly and pull the specimens out, put them on steel trolleys and learn them. And so they were objects in some ways, whereas this book, it's so beautiful. The pictures are of whole bodies, and you see the facial expressions of the quietly dead, and I found it amazing to look at.
And still do?
Well, I haven't looked at it for years until you asked me, and so I pulled it out, and I still have that emotional response to it. Yes, definitely.
And Karen Hitchcock, as well as being a physician, is also a fiction writer. In her collection of short stories called Little White Slips, there's a story there about med students at their first anatomy class. There's a link to that on the Body Sphere website. Let's get back, though, to the 19th century tale of two doctors, the Henrys, Grey and Carter, and Ruth Richardson, the author of The Making of Mr. Grey's Anatomy. And why Grey's Anatomy, or should that be Grey and Carter's Anatomy, was so much more successful than others.
The main book that they were really competing with was called Quain's Anatomy, and that was in three volumes, three small volumes, like a triple-decker Victorian novel. But the trouble is, there's lots and lots of cross-referencing between the volumes, so you really have to have all three of them in your pocket. And also, the illustrations are tiny, and they can't put the words on the structures. What they do is put A, B, C, D, or 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way round the little structures, and then they have a footnote at the bottom of the page saying what the key is to the illustration. So your eye is constantly jumping from the illustration down to the footnote and back. And it's really difficult to use, really hard. But in Grays, they were using what they call the multiple block engraving. Carter did the illustration direct on the block. He drew it in reverse directly on the wood block. And the size made such a difference to the drawings, because they're basically maps of anatomy with the words written on the structures. So if you look for a particular muscle, you'll see the muscle and the name runs along it. You can learn so much more easily than in Quain. And in fact, reviewers say that about Grays. They say there's never any doubt what the labels refer to.
But also, what became Such a strength of the book, as you say, the size of its illustrations, was actually nearly its downfall, wasn't it? In that the illustrations were actually bigger than they should have been.
I'm not certain how it happened, but I suspect it was something to do with Gray thinking he knew what he was doing and actually not having a real understanding of printing. So when Carter had done all these images and the engravers had engraved nearly all of them, there's suddenly a bit of a terrible hoo-ha, actually, because suddenly they realise when the first lot goes to the printer can't set the text round the illustrations because there's no room. All the illustrations are too large. They haven't made allowance for fitting into the what they call the form or the former, which is the metal box that holds the old-fashioned type. And so the printers and the publishers had an absolute nightmare to face to try and deal with it. Luckily, the publishers had gone to a really good printer, a firm called Wertheimer, and they invaded the margins all the way through the book and until where the wood engravers had got up to, where they hadn't quite started the wood engraving at the end of the book. They've been reduced in size. But most of the book, especially the beginning, things are gigantic. The images take full pages and they often go right into the margins. And I mean, nobody had noticed this about Gray's until I started the book. And I only noticed it because in Carter's diary, there's this one reference, something about images too large for the book. I should have trusted my intuition or something. Gray will get out of this. Gray will wriggle out of responsibility as usual. That's not a direct quote, but that's the gist of it. So Carter is left holding the baby at that stage because Gray has gone off to work for an aristocrat as his private doctor. So Gray isn't around when this happens and Carter's blamed for it effectively.
Mm. By the way, Ruth, do Carter's original illustrations, the original woodblocks, still exist?
No, sadly, the woodblocks don't, or at least if they do, I've not found them. What does survive is a most beautiful scrapbook in the Royal College of Surgeons in London. The engraver, the wood engraver, Butterworth and Heath, somehow stayed in business right into the 20th century, and I think it's round about the Great War period, maybe just after the Great War, they donate it. They donate their own scrapbook to the Royal College full of India proofs. It's the first impression, so it's fresh from the engraver's tools. So it's very clean print, and the binding is handmade, and it's been given as a gift to the Royal College of Surgeons, and it's in their archive. And it's such a pleasure to see, because you open up and you see these are the first impressions of these fantastic illustrations from Carter. They're absolutely beautiful.
Well, now, I mentioned earlier the title page of the original edition, and staying with this point about the book being a work so dependent on its illustrations, perhaps even more so than the text, there's a very mealy-mouthed change that Henry Gray calls for when he got the proof sheet for the title page. Basically, Gray was trying to erase Carter from accreditation, really.
Yes, yes, he was. And it's very interesting. Gray died of smallpox when he was 34, and I think all his papers were destroyed. In those days, they used to burn everything when there was an infectious disease in the house. So I think that's what happened. There's no private papers, no diaries, no letters, hardly anything in his handwriting. But I found this incredibly revealing title page, and I found it quite late on when I was doing the research. I thought I had got his character from various bits of research that I had done. For example, nobody wrote any memoir of him, really. There were obituaries, but nothing kindly written after him, and nobody said anything nice about Gray. They said he was clever, but they didn't say nice things about him, even though he died in such an awful way. But very late on in my work, I was at the Royal College of Surgeons in Edinburgh, and I asked about the first edition, and the young man who dealt with me said, there is something in the safe. I don't quite know what it is, but there is something in the safe to do with Gray's anatomy. And it really was the most extraordinary discovery. They are the first edition proofs with Gray's corrections all over them. And the most important thing to reveal his character was his marks on the front page, on the title page. He basically cut through Carter's name.
Crossed it out.
Yes. Well, it's called Anatomy Descriptive and Surgical by Henry Gray, Fellow of the Royal Society, Lecturer in Anatomy, St George's Hospital Medical School. That's very clear at the top of the page. So Gray has absolute prime position, and it's clear who's in charge of the book. But below him, it says the illustrations by Henry Van Dyke Carter. And he'd cut through the Henry Van Dyke Carter type and put an arrow down lower on the page and said, use this type size.
Smaller.
So, yes, much smaller, much smaller. Underneath Henry Van Dyke Carter's name, there was a completely black line, which I couldn't read behind. And you could see that the nib, you know, those old-fashioned nibs, Gray had pressed so hard on it, it had just widened right out to obliterate a complete line of type. And under the complete line of type, it said, Professor of Anatomy, Grant College, Bombay.
Which was the Carter's position job. He'd gone to.
Yes, that was Carter's new job. He'd left England because he knew he couldn't do well here. He'd gone to work in Bombay. Underneath that, it said late demonstrator of anatomy at St George's Hospital Medical School. And late, if that's all you leave, it looks as though he's died. You know, if it doesn't say professor of anatomy, it looks as though he's died.
And of course, as you say, the irony of this is that it was Gray who met an early death just 3 years after the publication of Gray's Anatomy, when he was only 34 years old. He died of smallpox. So he didn't really live to reap the rewards of his book in fame or in fortune.
No, he did in fortune. His family received royalties for it, and right
but
into the 20th
personally.
Century. He didn't personally. And what he did reap was criticism in the national medical press. And actually, he was accused of plagiarism, which I don't think is altogether fair, because anatomy, it's working on the same text over and over again. The human body is the same text. And the knowledge of anatomy has accrued over centuries from Vesalius onwards. And even Vesalius was using earlier sources.
Well, you say, I think, that in a beautiful way, that human anatomy is a palimpsest of knowledge.
Yes, yes, exactly. It is. The whole discipline is a palimpsest. And so, really, Gray can't be completely blamed for using other people's work. What he was blameworthy for was not giving them credit. And one of the reviews is really clear. It gives you parallel texts showing that Gray had taken text directly from other sources and had not even said anywhere that he owed anything to anybody else. And that was what upset people about Gray, was that the arrogance of pretending that it was all his own work. It was really quite shocking.
And if you look at Gray's Anatomy now, in its 40th edition, you'll see a huge list of credits for all the various editors and contributors. It's still just got that one name, though, forever associated with it and in the title, the ambitious and driven anatomist and surgeon who died young, just 3 years after the original publication, Henry Gray. Let's also, though, remember his silent partner, Henry Carter, who did the illustrations. There are details for Ruth Richardson's book, The Making of Mr. Gray's Anatomy, and Richard Barnett's book, The Sick Rose, on the Bodysphere website, abc.net.au/rn. From the list of programs there, choose the Bodysphere. And that's where you can listen online or download this program and leave a comment. Have you got an old copy of Gray's Anatomy around somewhere? I'm Amanda Smith.